Hello again. My name is Angel Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Writing so extensively about a crime has really changed how I look at it. Now, I was never a fan of what people call murder porn, that gratuitous detail for the sake of shock. It's exploitative, really. Maybe all true crime can be considered as such, but I don't think it is. Some details are important to express what the victims and survivors went through. And what is most important always is to keep those people in mind, the victims and the survivors. I'm from Massachusetts. I live here now. But for a period of time, I lived in southern New Hampshire. It's a lovely place with lovely people. And part of me will always be there. I liken it to that joke about your sister. I can make jokes about my sister, but no one else can. I can make jokes about New Hampshire, but you cannot. This is a story that has bothered me since the day it happened. I didn't set out to make this podcast about New England. But turns out I have a lot of stories about it to come. I would like to tell you the story of Kim and Jamie Cates. It's Crime of the New England Kind. Mount Vernon, New Hampshire is a small town in the southern part of the state. It's a picture-perfect town. It was a community of about 2,400 people as of the 2010 census. It's rural, it has dirt roads, and covers only 16.7 square miles. So a village, really. It's the kind of town where you often hear people say they never lock their doors. You know how I feel about that. It's a beautiful place with lots of room in between. If you want privacy, this is a very good place to find it. It had a general store, one public school, the Mount Vernon Village School, covering grades kindergarten through sixth. Now, nothing goes on here. And I know firsthand because I went to school in the next town over. We had a regional school for three towns, Milford, Amherst, Mount Vernon. Us kids could often be found hanging out on the Oval, many of us earning the nickname Ovaltines. Yes, it's the green space in the town center with a bandstand, if I recall, some flagpoles in the middle of the traffic circle through the center of Milford. We drank at a young age. We tried drugs. We skipped school. We hung out. And we dreamed about being somewhere, anywhere, more exciting. Along with Amherst, a bordering town, Mount Vernon was part of MASH, Milford Area Senior High. I believe we had 301 students in our graduating class. That's not very big. Sometime in the mid-90s, the town split and Amherst built Sauhegan Cooperative High School. Mount Vernon joined them and Milford remained the bastard child of the tri-town area. The impact of the Cates case cannot be understated. It shook the community to its core and injected fear into everyone. The effects were felt for miles. I was long gone from that New Hampshire town by then, but my heart was right there when I heard that news. A Mount Vernon family was met with pure evil on that night. The Cates family moved to Mount Vernon to experience life in a small town. Mom Kimberly graduated from the nursing program at Pima Community College in Tucson. While living in Arizona, she worked at Tucson Medical Center. She married David Cates in 1997, and a year later, their only daughter, Jamie Lynn, was born. From Arizona, they moved to Baltimore, and in 2004, they came to New England, settling in Mount Vernon. Kim worked as a registered nurse at St. Joseph's Hospital in Nashua, Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, and the Milford Medical Center in downtown Milford. Friends called Kim a friendly spirit with lots of energy, and she was often seen running through the neighborhood. Jamie, her 11-year-old daughter, was a happy girl and had earned her black belt in karate 4 months earlier. The night before, she was at a dance with her friends. On the night of October 3rd, 2009, Kim and Jamie were at home while her husband and Jamie's dad, David, was away on business. David Cates testified that he traveled more than 20 times per year for his job as an engineer with BAE Systems. It was common, it happened a lot, and Kim and Jamie were used to it. Kim was known to be very diligent about safety and locking her doors. The home had an alarm system, but it wasn't something that they used regularly. It was an uneventful Saturday, and an uneventful Saturday night for Kim and Jamie. The two were very close, and they planned shopping over the weekends and just to hang out together. That Saturday night, they went to bed early, about 8:30. It was something they were known to do. And rather than calling and disturbing them, David texted one last time that evening, not knowing what was about to visit them. How could he know? Jamie was asleep with her mother in her parents' bed, a common thing for the two to bunk with each other in the master bedroom. Lots of parents and kids do it. And sometime in the middle of that night, Kim was startled awake. Early on the morning of Sunday, October 4th, 2009, Milford Police 911 received a call from the residents at 4 Trow Road in Mount Vernon. The caller had reported that a robbery and an assault had taken place on the property. Milford Police Sergeant Kevin Furlong was first to arrive at the scene. Through a window, he saw someone lying on the floor, covered in blood. The officer smashed through the door with his shoulder and entered the home where he found a gravely injured Jamie Cates. Bleeding and in shock, she was suffering multiple visible injuries. The unknown assailants had clearly intended to kill her, and they came very close, nearly severing major arteries. The reporting officer testified part of her foot was missing and others were barely still attached. She was attempting to scream and yell, however, nothing was coming out. He testified that Jamie told him they killed Mommy. A surgeon who operated on Jamie testified that a blow that lacerated the girl's face was delivered with such force it broke her jaw. Another blow cleaved into the back of her head hard enough to crease her skull. She had stab wounds on two sides of her heart, a long gash on her face above her throat, and a deep gash above her hip that nearly penetrated her abdominal cavity. Jamie Cates told police she survived by playing dead as her attackers kicked and hacked at her. Once she felt the intruders had gone, Jamie summoned the strength to get up, bleeding heavily, and made her way to a phone to call for help. Unsure who may still be inside the house, the officer carried Jamie outside to safety as other officers were arriving and EMS was en route. The officer then returned to search the house. Kim Cates was located in her bedroom and suffering from multiple, visible, and fatal injuries to her body. Certainly, a scene like this is traumatic and confusing. I mean, why would someone attack a family like this? There is no sensical answer to that. As the investigation into the murder of Kimberly Cates and the attempted murder of Jamie Cates begins, some very disturbing information comes to light. The New Hampshire television news station WMUR Channel 9 begins extensive coverage, and the story breaks nationwide. Reports come out about the family. Kim Cates was a nurse and a dedicated and loving mom whose life was taken by strangers that invaded her home at random. The only non-random thing about it is that their home was remote, no close neighbors, on a rural road. Her only daughter was brutally attacked and left for dead. Her survival is owed to her ability to fool the murderers into thinking they'd killed her, then crawling from the bedroom, withstanding her painful injuries. Had Jamie not summoned that strength to call for help, she would have lost consciousness and died from a punctured lung before she was discovered. She suffered tremendous injuries, 18 blows to her body so savage that part of her foot was recovered at the scene. Her head struck with such force, it was split and her jaw was broken. Such injuries had to have come from a heavy and sharp weapon, such as a machete, several doctors had testified. The killers violently slashed at Kim. She had over 32 injuries, several broken bones from the brute force. Her skull was split. Several organs were pierced by the murder weapon. Her left eye socket destroyed, and her throat was cut. No human could withstand such brutality. hacked to death for trying to shield her daughter. And then, just like that, they were gone. Haven't gotten what they came for. David Cates was contacted by authorities and booked a flight to return home immediately. He learns his wife Kim has been murdered and that his only daughter Jamie is in very serious condition. He gets more information about the home invasion while waiting at the airport. Simply grueling to have this information delivered to you and have to sit on a plane. It's unfathomable, really. Jamie is airlifted to Children's Hospital in Boston, where she undergoes 6 hours of surgery. She's then placed in the ICU in stable condition. The scene at the Cates home that night is so traumatic that the EMS trauma coordinator reported emergency personnel who responded to the scene had to meet with a mental health worker at the Southern New Hampshire Medical Center in Nashua. The safest statement they could make about what they experienced that night was, "It was a horrible event." A joint statement is released by the New Hampshire Attorney General, the New Hampshire State Police, and the Mount Vernon Police Chief, saying an autopsy was performed on Kimberly Cates, born March 6, 1967, by Deputy Chief Medical Examiner Jenny Duval the day after her death. Dr. Duval determined that the cause of death was multiple sharp injuries to the head, torso, left arm, and left leg. She concluded that the death was a homicide and that Kimberly Cates was alive for all 32 blows she sustained by her killers. Investigators had begun the arduous process of piecing together the events of October 4th and the attacks on Kim and Jamie Cates. They now know there were multiple assailants involved and need to move quickly to find them. It did not take long before suspects in the Cates case began to surface. Police are tipped off to possible suspects, a group of local teenagers. Stephen Spader, age 17, from Brookline, New Hampshire. 19-year-old Christopher Gribble, also Brookline, New Hampshire. 18-year-old William Marks and 17-year-old Quinn Glover, both of Amherst, New Hampshire. On the afternoon of the attacks on Jamie and Kim, the authorities received a call from a friend of Spader and Glover, telling them that the boys had visited him at home and told him many details about what happened in Mount Vernon. In an interview with police, the friend detailed the story of the boys breaking into a house and attacking a woman and a child in their bed. The friend reported that the boys showed him two knives, which may have been used in the crime. By this time, news of the Mount Vernon home invasion was everywhere, and armed with this information, this friend was compelled to report what they knew. Jimmy Hollins and Kyle Fenton were at Fenton's home in Amherst when Spader, Gribble, and Marks came by and bragged about what they had done to the Cates family. Once they left, the two searched for news on the Mount Vernon house. Kyle Fenton told his mother what they just heard, and she called the police to report it. When investigators showed up to interview Fenton and Hollins, they reported everything the boys had just bragged to them about regarding the grisly attacks at the Trout Road home, where Fenton said everybody seemed very happy about telling their story about the murder. Jamie Hollins was haunted by what he knew from that day forward and didn't sleep for 3 months after. He did not want to be involved and was afraid to testify in the murder cases. Jamie Hollins was found dead in his bed by his mother the following summer. No cause of death was reported. In 2014, Kyle Fenton himself made the news and pleaded guilty to 3 counts of felonious sexual assault and was sentenced to 2 to 7 years in prison. Today, he is a registered sex offender and lives in Bennington, New Hampshire. Investigators went looking for the boys for questioning and found Stephen Spader, Christopher Gribble, and another friend, Autumn Savoy, that evening at Spader's home in Brookline, New Hampshire, about 20 minutes from the Mount Vernon crime scene. Police questioned Savoy, who first gave an alibi for Spader and Gribble. Autumn Savoy later changed the story and gave up everything he knew about the Kim Cates murder, bringing investigators to the location at the Nashua River where evidence was dumped. The following day, Monday, October 5th, 2009, a school resource officer at Sauhegan High School in nearby Amherst contacted detectives after a student there reported being threatened. The student, believed to be Eldon Spikes, told the resource officer that the suspects had discussed many details of the crimes with him and were celebrating their feat and hoping to do it again. Spike said he had gone with Christopher Gribble to pawn jewelry, jewelry he now believed to have been stolen from the Cates' home at the Pheasant Lane Mall in Nashua. Some locals call it the Pheasant Lane Mall. It's a mall, like most malls. In 2011, Eldon Spikes finds himself in trouble. He broke into the house of an Amherst, New Hampshire politician. Spikes forced his way into the house through a back door and was held at gunpoint by the homeowner until the police arrived. He was incoherent and talking about his connection to the Stephen Spader murder case. Quinn Glover and William Marks were both at school at Sauhegan on that Monday, the day after Kim Cates was killed and Jamie was recovering from extensive surgery in the ICU at a Boston hospital. Both were questioned by police at the end of the school day. Quinn Glover initially admitted that they were in Mount Vernon at the time of the killing, but said little else before asking for an attorney. William Marks gave details of the crime, telling police how he entered the house through a basement window in order to let the boys in, but he couldn't get into the upstairs. William Marks couldn't get out of the basement, and we know from records that the boys gained access into the house through an air conditioning vent. Damn it, now I'm going to be thinking about my AC units. Marks told police that he later made it into the rest of the home and heard a woman's voice say something like, "Jamie, is that you?" In statements Marks made to the police, he spoke of hearing Kim Cates say something like, "You don't have to do this," and then, "You're going to be okay." He was in the bedroom a few minutes later and saw them after they had been attacked. In subsequent interviews, Marks admitted that he had helped search for a location to break into and that they thought the Cates home on Trail Road was empty until they heard a woman's voice. Between the time it took for the friends of the group to contact the police to the time they interviewed William Marks and Quinn Glover, less than 48 hours had passed from the time Kim and Jamie Cates were attacked. Call it good police work, maybe, but it was made easy because the boys were so proud of their work and were unable to shut up about it. Something about psychopaths, isn't it? Early on the morning of Tuesday, October 6th, the State Attorney General's office issued a press release to the media that said four arrests had been made in connection to the Mount Vernon home invasion and the murder of Kim Cates and the attack on Jamie Cates. Before noon on that same day, Stephen Spader, Christopher Gribble, William Marks, and Quinn Glover were arraigned one by one at Milford District Court. We're talking 2 days. It took 2 days to get these guys. Because they are pretty fucking stupid. They told everybody. Idiots. The 13-page arrest affidavit that details interviews with the suspects and Jamie Cates was sealed and not released until January 5th, 2010. At that time, additional details of the crime were made public. In the documents, Jamie Cates told investigators that she was sleeping with her mother in her parents' room when her mother woke up in the middle of the night asking if she had heard a noise. She said her mom went to the door to check on the noise and was attacked by something she called a sword. She jumped up and tried to protect her mother, and the weapon was turned on her. Jimmy attempted to run, but Gribble stopped her, stabbing her in the right lung, and he tried to stab her in the heart through the back. Gribble then threw the girl against the glass door, where she got tangled in the curtains and she fell to the floor. He then kicked her and slashed her in the face with a machete. Jamie told investigators that she pretended to be dead as Gribble checked on her mother. During his interrogation, Christopher Gribble had asked investigators how the girl was, not out of compassion, clearly, but to say that had he known Jamie was still alive, he would have killed her because he didn't want her to have to live with the aftermath of the killing. Don't buy that. The boys ended up taunting each other over the success of one in murdering their victim and seeing the survival of the other as a failure. In fact, they enjoyed it. They got off on it. They were thrilled with themselves, and they wanted everybody to know. And many of the professionals close to this case do believe that they would kill again. What we learn about the disaffected teenagers from this point on is disturbing. The youngest of the group, high school dropout Stephen Spader, who turned 18 in the month after the crimes, is believed to be the mastermind, a former Boy Scout. Spader had formed a club he called the Disciples of Destruction shortly before the murder and was enlisting members. Spader designed a logo with the initials DOD and told his recruits that the home invasion was an initiation for members. Their plan was to break in and rob the home and kill anyone who may be inside. They did it strictly for the thrill of it. In fact, they were energized. Friends reported he was euphoric after. He bragged about the murder, even writing in gratuitous detail about the condition of a fatally battered Kim Cates. We can go over and over about why two seemingly normal teenage white boys from a middle-class area decided to murder and attempt to murder an innocent family. They wanted to. That's the answer. They wanted to kill. William Marks, Quinn Glover, and Autumn Savoy were just dumb kids playing a game. Maybe they were influenced by the idea of being part of a crew or a gang, or saw somebody like Steven Spader as a leader. A lost leader. Kid never even made it through high school. A lot was made of the boys having shaved heads, and I found little that actually addressed it. Most references suggested they were neo-Nazis. Now, there's no evidence of this. The media certainly sensationalized this point. The shaved heads could be one of two things. Part of their supposed initiation, or an attempt at keeping the crime scene free of their DNA. Plausible. In documents released in 2013 for a resentencing hearing after a Supreme Court ruling vacated Spader's sentence, interviews with his parents, Christine and Steven Spader Sr., show that they have never discussed what happened that night in Mount Vernon with their only son. That indicates to me they believe their son is guilty of the crimes he is accused and convicted of. The Spaders shared that he was adopted in Arizona when he was 5 days old after testing positive for marijuana and cocaine at birth. Coming from what appears as a well-off family, he had an idyllic childhood with big birthday celebrations and family vacations, and where education was a priority. When Spader hit middle school, things changed. His parents were determined to get him help, seeking counseling and medication and taking a loan against their mortgage to send him to an exclusive behavioral program. That same year, 2008, he was diagnosed as bipolar. Like many kids his age, he started smoking pot and doing harder drugs in high school. Court records show Spader had a criminal history. In August 2009, he served 13 days in jail after admitting he threatened a group of teenagers by waving a tire iron at them after ramming their car in a chase. There are convictions for trespassing, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, all within the several months leading up to the Mount Vernon attacks. He had been scheduled to be arraigned on marijuana possession and was facing possession of stolen stereo equipment charges at the time of the attacks. Parents of his friends worried that the influence Spader might have on their kids. William Marks' father said that he rued the day he met Spader and that he acted as though he were a gang leader. In those 2013 documents, we learn that Steven Spader's parents visited their son regularly in prison, and he has never expressed remorse for anything. 2 months before the Cates murder, Steven Spader told his family that his girlfriend was pregnant. They were supportive and told him of his own biological family and that he had brothers. He later cried with his aunt about being given away by his natural parents. It's unclear what, if anything, that this or the revelation that he was adopted had on his behavior. Because of the U.S. Supreme Court's Miller v. Alabama ruling that restricted the sentencing of minors to life sentences, both Steven Spader and Christopher Gribble were granted sentencing rehearings. For this reason, these documents were unsealed. We learn that Spader, content with his life sentence, told his attorneys during an April 2013 resentencing hearing that he did not want a reduction in sentence, describing himself as the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet. It is the state of New Hampshire's belief that Steven Spader did not have remorse for his crimes, that he considered it unnecessary and a form of weakness, and would likely commit more crimes upon release from prison. In May 2013, the New Hampshire Supreme Court allowed Steven Spader to drop the appeal of his conviction. Christopher Gribble, the other killer, because saying a partner in crime is a little too folksy and a demeaning statement when a so-called partnership left a woman dead and a child gravely injured and a father out of his mind with guilt. You know, David Cates beat himself up over what happened. All I can hope for now is that David Cates has found some peace all these years later. Christopher Gribble came from a Mormon family. He was homeschooled by his mother. This contributed to his difficulty in social situations. Acquaintances had said he was awkward and laughed nervously and just couldn't pick up on social cues. Even his father said Christopher was intelligent and eloquent, but had trouble telling when someone wanted to stop talking to him or picked up on other cues. There's no record of graduation from any school, and was described as being a devout member of the Mormon Church and was working to become a missionary. By all accounts, his parents were together, so divorce wasn't a factor. He has one older brother. And like Stephen Spader, Gribble was a Boy Scout, and he built a shed for the Brookline Transfer Station as part of an Eagle Scout project. As a member of the ROTC, he talked about his favorite weapons, once posting on Facebook, "Anything sharp, really, but I love swords and knives." Gribble was tried separately from Stephen Spader. He used the mental illness defense at his trial, saying he committed the crimes he is accused of, but that he was insane when he did so. New Hampshire is the only state that does not require a medical diagnosis of mental illness or disorder to decide if a defendant is insane. Gribble said he was diagnosed with antisocial and personality disorder in 2007. He told the judge he was not taking any psychiatric medication or receiving any treatment for this diagnosis, and that initially he had used Prozac. Neighbors in the town of Brookline were in shock after learning that the boys, who came from seemingly good middle-class families and participated in activities like school musicals and the Boy Scouts, could be capable of such brutality. Gribble claimed his home life was tense and called his mother a liar when she took the stand at his trial to talk about his childhood. He claimed abuse and talked of wanting to kill his own mother. By entering a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity to charges of murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder and burglary, and witness tampering, he waived his right to a jury trial on whether he killed Kim Cates and attempted to kill Jamie. The burden was placed on his attorney to prove he was mentally unstable during the Mount Vernon home invasion. If the jury had found that he was sane at the time, it would be life in prison without the possibility of parole. If jurors found him not guilty by reason of insanity, the Superior Court judge would hold a hearing on whether he was a danger to society. There is a chance that if found not guilty by reason of insanity in the state of New Hampshire, that Gribble would have been committed to a secure psychiatric unit in the New Hampshire State Prison. Gribble took the stand at his trial. In the multiple videos from the trials, most courtesy of WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire, you can see he is calm, smug, and defiant, and mentally ill, but not insane. During each of the boys' murder trials, the story of the early morning random attacks on Kim and Jamie Cates play out in the courtroom. The boys met in a Walmart parking lot in Amherst and drove to the house. William Marks, the smallest of the four, at 5'3", was to break in through a basement window and let the others into the house. The door from the cellar into the house was locked, and we now know he got stuck down there for a period of time. Instead, one of the boys made entrance into the home through an air conditioning vent. Once inside, they cut the power on the circuit breaker and used an iPod taken from Jamie's room to light their way down the hall to the master bedroom. At first, they claimed they didn't think anybody was home, but declared at the beginning that if it turned out that anyone was inside while they attempted to rob it, they would kill them. Get the feeling that they were hoping someone was home? Yeah, me too. Stephen Spader and Christopher Gribble's grisly ambush of Kim and Jamie in the pitch black of their bedroom was all a part of their plan. Each wanted to kill, Gribble admitting that he'd thought about it for a long time, even talking about how he fantasized about torturing his own mother. Spader and Gribble are sociopaths. They readily admit that. It is very possible that the two of them would have killed again. In fact, they had been threatening the people they told about the murders not to tell. That's because they're not smart. Many of the media's retelling of the events of October 4th, 2009 include the boys having an obsession with the TV show Dexter. It's about a Miami forensic blood splatter expert by day and a serial killer by night. First, there's no evidence that they emulated this fictional character. That's aside from a Facebook post that Gribble made on the day of the murder to line up with an alibi Autumn Savoy had created with them. And we all know Dexter had a code. They're killers. Plain and simple. They wanted to be. Stephen Spader, State Bureau Identification Number OS 01705691. That's long. He is 28 years old. His original sentence of life plus 76 years was upheld. He drops all appeals and is serving his time in New Jersey. He will never get out of prison. Christopher Gribble, inmate 88327, is now 31 years old. He was found sane and sentenced to life in prison. He remains jailed at the New Hampshire State Prison in Concord. He maxes out on 272206. That's in 186 years. He will be 217 years old. William Marks is 28. The kid who got stuck in the basement, he is serving 30 to 60 years in New Hampshire State Prison in Concord. He maxes out on March 21st, 2047, when he is 55 years old. Quinn Glover, 28, who took part in the burglary but not the murder, is serving 20 to 40 years in the New Hampshire State Prison Concord. He maxes out on 9/20/2034. He could get out of jail by the time he's 42. The fifth suspect, Autumn Savoy, who was providing the alibi and helped dump evidence, agreed to cooperate with the prosecutor and testify for the state. He pleaded guilty to hindering prosecution and conspiracy in exchange for a recommended sentence of 5 to 19 years in prison. He was paroled in 2005 and returned to Hollis. Dexter is returning with a 10-episode limited series with Michael C. Hall. Production is set to begin at the end of the year with a late 2021 premiere date. Legislators in New Hampshire removed to strengthen penalties for murder during home invasions in the wake of the death of Kim Cates in her home in Mount Vernon. Today, Jamie is a college graduate. She studied public health and played field hockey at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is active in the Kimberly Cates Memorial Fund and has given out more than $250,000 in scholarships, all to students who continue her legacy of helping others. You can learn more about it, KimCatesFund.org. Kim Cates was a kind and compassionate healthcare professional. I cannot help but think that now, in the days of COVID-19, that she would be on the front line saving people. Because I think that's the person that Kim Cates was. The house on Fortrow Road in Mount Vernon was sold in 2018. I hope that means that David Cates is happy and maybe he's found love again. Thank you for listening. My name is Angel Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Many stories to come, a lot of which are set in New England. Yes, it's true. You can find the show everywhere you get your podcasts. Murder Stories. Online, crimeofthetruestkind.com. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And remember, lock your damn doors. And vote! Vote your ass off.